Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Core Intuition, just having a safety valve.
Manton Reese, we are on the eve of something allegedly very important and special.
Something special that I will immediately be ordering.
Something or some things?
Well, some things, but I'll only be ordering the iPad mini. You know, I didn't buy the iPhone 5 yet, as we talked about. I also never got around to getting the iPad 3, so I've skipped the last two iOS gadgets. I feel like I'm due to immediately buy the iPad mini on day one.
You've earned this.
Yeah.
Did you happen to see the Saturday Night Live skit about the all the iPhone problems? And
oh, yeah. That's great.
The first world problems. Like, well, I haven't had an iPhone 5, and I didn't get an iPad 3. So, I mean, come on. I'm teasing.
That's me.
I'm excited about... It's funny, Manton. I seem to be, like, more excited by iPads and tablets than I ever actually... I don't actually use them that much, but I just get excited about them. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm a perfect customer for Apple.
It's funny. I actually haven't been using my iPad 2 much lately, mostly because I half bricked it because the betas in iOS 6, I mean, it's not bricked, but you know, I had the betas expire and I haven't gotten it back to, the way it needs to be for day-to-day use.
Yeah, well, I'm excited about this other rumor that there's going to be not just an iPad mini, but a Mac mini.
Yeah, how about that?
Well, I'm first of all, you know, it's been perennial, like, rumor threat that Apple will eventually just get rid of the Mac mini. I don't know why they would, but I always start, you know, quivering in my boots, quavering. What is it? quaggering. I get scared when I hear rumors of Apple eliminating the Mac Mini because it's one of my favorite Macs, and I have been using a Mac Mini in my living room for a long time now. And I think this is the one I have now is my second version. So I've had them for years as kind of like the beating heart of my home entertainment system and my home build server and stuff like that. So I run my backups off of it. It's like this great thing that I use for automated builds. And I have this new idea now that I want to, well, first of all, I want it to be faster. So I want a brand new one. And I was thinking, I need to get a new one because this one's getting a little old. And then I Google, is it a good time to buy a Mac Mini or something? And it says, and you know, I Googled this just like yesterday, and it says, rumor, Mac Mini's coming out next week. I was like, oh, well, that's convenient.
Don't get one yet then.
Yeah.
I wonder if it'll be faster or smaller, or because I think about like the Apple TV, which used to look like a Mac Mini. And now it's this tiny little,
right.
like 3 inches or, you know, it's really tiny device. It would be funny if they could even get the Mac Mini smaller than it used to be. I don't know if that's realistic though with hard drives. I just replaced our time capsule. Usually on the time capsules, which is like the, you know, it's Wi-Fi router, but it has a hard drive built in. Usually people complain that the hard drive fails in those things after like a year and a half. And mine never did. It lasted a couple of years. It was something else. The Ethernet port had problems. And I replaced that. But that, I don't know. That's a similar device. It looks kind of like the Mini, but it has a big hard drive in it.
Yeah. Well, I'm still attached to the kind of, you know, what is it, like 6 inches square kind of profile. I already have like my AirPort. It's the same kind of square shape, and then I bought this third party DVD drive that kind of fits on top, and so I like the trend towards just making it more of a flat pancake. You know, it's like it's getting flatter and flatter without changing its dimensions. I could like put two of the last generation Mac Mini stacked on top, and it would be like the same height as my current Mini. You know, that's in large part because they dropped the DVD drive from that that last iteration, and I'm sure that, sure they're not adding it back. But
no, I doubt
the resurgence of the DVD. You heard it here first.
It's back.
I'm seeing big things for optical discs. Oh boy. Well, anyway, one of the reasons I want to get a nice, fast, new Mac Mini is because, as folks know, I like to do this automated build server thing with Jenkins. But what I'm running up against now is, thanks to Apple's forward-looking technology attitude, you know, I can't run the newest Xcode on my 10.6 based Mac Mini. I can upgrade that Mac Mini, I think, even up to Mountain Lion, but then I wouldn't be able to run the old Xcode to, I still have these old projects that I build with Xcode 3, and I build even for like 10.4 support. Mm-hmm. I mean, call me crazy. I am crazy, but you know,
you are crazy.
It's one of those things where I have this commitment to maintaining the status quo for my old apps, and I haven't been putting any work into the like old apps like FlexTime.
Yeah.
I haven't been putting any work into them significantly, so I can't really like justify a 2.0 version or something.
Yeah.
Which is again where I would feel comfortable dropping support for old systems. So
right. I still have a whole bunch of Xcode versions lying around too, but it's getting a little bit old. I think at some point I'm gonna let that stuff go and just stay on the current and maybe the previous. Because it's out of control. I mean, I've got Xcode 3, I've got an Xcode 2.5.
How are you running that Xcode 2.5? You have an old.
Oh, I haven't tried running it lately. Oh. Does it not run under? Does it not run anymore?
I don't.
It ran on 10.7.
I don't think so. I think you're going to be. I think you're going to be out of luck. I mean, especially. Well, I think it's impossible. I shouldn't say impossible. It's.
Let me rephrase why I have it. I have it for Interface Builder. So.
Oh right.
Interface Builder. I haven't run on 10.8, but I'm pretty sure it ran under 10.7.
Yeah.
Xcode itself, I have no need for. I don't need to build anything.
Okay.
On those, I purely have that old version for Interface Builder, old nibs. Old nib plugins, but at some point it just becomes kind of ridiculous. And Apple is so aggressive about wanting developers to just target the latest version of the OS and leading by example, you know, their latest round of iOS apps require iOS 6, you know, they immediately went in that direction. So at some point you just kind of have to just kind of follow what Apple's doing. And
yeah, well, this is the thing. You do have to do that. However, since Apple started allowing virtualization in 10.7, we are in a position now where going forward, we can continue to run anything important enough to keep running on even a new Mac with a virtualized 10.7. And if you are creative enough, a virtualized 10.6. My plan now is to get my Mac Mini up and running with 10.8, the latest stuff, all the latest Xcode, and then have like a virtualized old machine running on the same Mac at the same time, because you know I use this Jenkins automated continuous integration thing, and it has the notion of like multiple machines, like slave machines. So I can have like a slave build machine running in a virtualized old Mac OS, and then I can kind of move forward and stay behind.
That's great though. I'd love to see you write that up, or you know, if you get all that working, tell other people how to do it, because that's very cool. That's something I wish I had. I'm sure I've said this before. I wish I had a more formal automated build system.
Yeah, it's funny, it's one of those things that's probably. The argument goes both ways. I'm about to say I think it's really important for a one-person shop because it sort of magnifies all of your abilities. Anything that automates things for you when you're a one-person shop is like, okay, all this stuff that would be like genuinely too much work and effort for me to go back to and go through and test every time is now done automatically for me. On the other hand, I'm sure, you know, the benefits are just as great and greater when it comes to kind of trying to coordinate lots of people working on the same stuff. So it's probably just a win all around, but I find it particularly, I feel like good when I like look at my automated build machine and I'm like, oh, this thing's been, you know, chugging away over here, running tests on my stuff as I change it. And every time it catches something, I'm like, oh, yep, that's one more bug. I didn't have to wait in Xcode as I was building the stuff and testing it, you know, testing it in the UI. I didn't have to like run all my unit tests all the time.
Right.
But I also didn't have to wait until some user out in the real world ran into the bug and reported it to me. So anyway, that's my latest Jenkins rant.
That's cool. Well, tomorrow we'll see what Apple announces. We're recording this right before they announce, the day before, but by the time listeners hear this, they'll probably have already announced it. I will have already ordered an iPad mini. You will already have ordered a Mac mini, hopefully. And what else do we think? You're going to have new MacBook 13-inch Retina?
I don't know. You know, I had the privilege of riding back from Singleton in Montreal with Dan Morin and Serenity Caldwell from Macworld. And they are just like the best people to have brainstorming what kind of stuff Apple's going to do at the announcement, because this is their job, right?
Right. Yep.
And frankly, I don't think any of us could figure it out. Like how is Apple going to spin this, right? Like we're thinking, oh, maybe it's a education, because, you know, there was that, I think it was Gruber had good insight that this is going to be perfect size and like kind of like if it has like a non-retina screen, which is sort of being hinted at, or at least, right. Or at least it's being hinted that it's just quote unquote, just going to be the same resolution as the standard iPad. Then it kind of makes sense as kind of a mass consumer, mass market reading device, like something, I guess kind of something like a Kindle Fire, right?
Right.
But then the questions come up, why do you have an education oriented announcement like a month into school?
Yeah, exactly.
And the other thing is, why do you have an education focused announcement and call in the global press to San Jose, right?
Right.
So, and then if you take the rumors about there being potentially a new MacBook Pro, I think that's another one, a new MacBook Pro. Did you throw that out already?
I did. I threw it out briefly. Yeah. Well, like, cause I didn't think they would do a Retina 13 inch until next year. So I'd be really surprised, cause they refreshed all these laptops at WWDC. So pretty much, I think they refreshed the whole line. So I'd be surprised if they do that, but everyone keeps saying that they're going to. So who knows? Just doing a Mac mini and an iPad mini seems like a lot to me. I think they could do an event just with the iPad mini. It's a brand new product and they'd be fine. Yeah, who knows? Maybe they're going to throw some extra stuff in. Maybe they're not going to have another event until early or mid next year. So they're going to get a couple good product announcements in now.
Well, the thing is, if they do just an iPad mini, how do they stretch that? I mean, how do they... This was the other problem. As much as we love the idea of an iPad mini, how do you sell the thing except it's a little smaller than your other iPad, bro?
Great.
You know, like how do you talk for an hour to the press about...
Here's how. You bring on at least 20 third-party demos. Bring them up on stage one after another to stretch that
one
thing out.
One terrible demo after another.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they can't stretch it to an hour. They could probably do half an hour. They could demo some apps. Maybe there's another Apple app or two or some refreshes that make it good. Maybe they talk about, I don't know. I don't know how they stretch it that much, but... You talk about the Apple stores for the first 10 minutes, how they're doing great. Another half an hour for the iPad mini. They can
stretch it. Yeah.
I'm excited about the device though. If you'd asked me a couple years ago, and maybe you did, I didn't think that they needed something in this size, but I'm convinced now. I mean, I think it would be really handy to have, not just for ebooks, but movies and general app use, you know, something that's a little more portable. can take around with you. I think it'll be good.
Me too. I think it'll prove to be the more popular size than the truck iPad, the big, you know. But we'll see. You know, this is going to be pretty boring, you and I speculating about stuff that's already come to pass. So
yep.
Maybe we should move on.
All right. This week, we have a new sponsor. It's Polite Picks and their Rapid Ears product. Polite Picks Rapid Ears is an iOS framework for real-time speech recognition that doesn't require network connection and is so responsive that you can use it as a gaming input. Great for any app with a moderately sized vocabulary that needs live speech recognition performed offline. Try out a demo of Rapid Ears and all the Open Ears platform plugins free of charge at politepicks.com/shop. Core Intuition listeners are invited to take 25% off the purchase of any Polite Picks product using the promo code Core Intuition. Rapid Ears. Try doing that over the network.
Well, this looks cool. This is, you know, sort of unlike something like Siri, obviously, where it's always sending everything out over the network. This is, you give it like a fixed vocabulary and it listens eagerly for those specific phrases. So if you had any app that has like, this is a lot, Manton, like the Mac OS speech recognition. It's been built in for a long time. Really cool for stuff when, you know, you have like, turn the page would be a good example, right? Like if you just want to have like some phrases that your app knows how to respond to.
Yeah. Great timing for an app like this. Because Siri it's been out for, I guess, a year now, and users are used to it and they kind of expect this, but there's no public API for Siri. You can't integrate well with it at all, right? It's up to Apple to do everything. So if you have an app that could take advantage of speech recognition or just text to speech, I mean, it seems like a great, great thing to integrate.
Yeah. I mean, really, that's as great as Siri is, the terrible frustration with it is that you have to be connected. I mean, you can't even say Siri, like what? I don't think you can even say like Siri, what time is it or something.
Mm-hmm.
It has to send your text over the network to figure it out.
That's true. Yeah. So this can work offline and you can integrate in your app and have custom, you know, triggers and words that you recognize.
Yep.
That there's no way Siri could do that with your app.
And the cool thing about this is it's based on a free, I think, open source framework. That's the Open Ears. And then there's just like goodies added on, including the Rapid Ears plugin that makes it like real fast, real time recognition instead of waiting until the phrase is completed. So this is real cool. Thanks again to Polite Picks. And once again, you can check it out at politepicks.com. All right, folks, it's time for our mostly regular listener Q&A section of the show. We have a question this week from Travis Estelle, and he asks, it's interesting to see the API strategy used by Twitter compared to other services like Instagram and Google+. Twitter, it seems, wants you to be able to post from anywhere, but force you to use the official website and apps to view your timeline. Meanwhile, Instagram and Google+ have launched read-only APIs that allow you to view your timelines using other apps, but require you to use the official sites to post. Both approaches have the same goal of forcing people to use the official app or site, since third-party apps can't be full-featured. I'd be interested to hear both of your thoughts on these two different approaches and the user experiences that they provide.
Yeah, great question. Thanks. And this is really relevant right now because just last week, Tweetbot for Mac shipped, and they made kind of a big deal about, you know, underscoring this user token limit that we've talked about before, which Twitter is using to really discourage mainstream Twitter apps. Tapbots did kind of a clever thing where they really spun this to their advantage, you know, saying this is why we're going to charge $20. We're going to charge more for our app because it's a limited resource. And I think it really helped get people on board with buying it right away, essentially, because who knows if next month you'll be able to buy the app. It might be
right.
Might be up. So it's frustrating having to work with Twitter when they have this attitude against developers. But I don't know, maybe as developers, we need to find ways that we can do clever things like what Tapbots did so we can kind of use this to our advantage, or or at least let it guide the kind of apps that we want to build if we still want to build for the platform.
Well, I guess that's what's interesting is obviously the way Travis phrased the question was using lots of language about things being outright disallowed, and Tweetbot is an example that it's not outright disallowed. It's just they're part of a incremental clampdown on what's allowed. But all the things, you know, reading the timeline and posting to Twitter are allowed. Just right now, you can only supply that functionality to 100,000 users, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's the crux of what Travis is getting at, I think, is why are these strategies different from one service to the other? Why does Google want you to be able to, you know, read stuff? Was that what I picked up from it? Read stuff from everywhere, but you have to go to the official site to post.
The other way. Twitter is okay for you. You can post from anything, but they want you to read tweets on the website or their official apps.
Right. And then it wasn't the implication that Google Plus does it the inverse, or?
Yeah. I don't know that much about the Google Plus API. He also mentioned Instagram, which is definitely like that. They want you to post pictures from the Instagram app, but they do have an API that allows you to sort of, you know, read pictures and favorites and things like that from any app. And, you know, this is a really great question. I don't know in Instagram's case why they care so much about this. Why can't you post a picture from anywhere? Is it just controlling the things like the, you know, the size and the image, right, and the filters and there's a cost for them when you're pushing, you know, JPEG data at their servers all the time. Maybe they just want to control the flow of that.
I think at least when Instagram was starting out, probably the filters were such a part of the trademark.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like, you know, what is Instagram? Well, it's this thing where you can publish photos that are square and have vintage-y filters applied to them. And if you just had people streaming a bunch of, you know, plain Jane, no filter stuff up there. You know, I think that's a good question is, now that Facebook owns Instagram, they are continuing to manage Instagram, seems like more or less the way that it was being managed before. You know, it's not like,
right.
So I don't think like Instagram photos are going straight to your Facebook timeline by default. Maybe they are.
No. It's easy to do that, but not by default to my knowledge.
Right. So it seems like it's sort of just like the policy at Instagram may be out of date now. Like, who knows if that's what Facebook really cares about? Just sort of keeping things the status quo.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can post to Facebook from anywhere. They just want to get all your data. Right. I mean,
right. Facebook has more kind of a similar attitude to Twitter, it seems like.
Yes. Yeah. They want to own the data.
Push everything in there.
And and it makes sense because, you know, they want to be able to put the ads on the timeline, but they want to be able to get all the information that they grow their service from.
So I also wonder with Instagram if this was purposeful or if it was just kind of an accident with how the service developed. Because for the longest time, and this is still kind of true, they had no web interface. They had no API at the beginning. You know, it was all focused around the app. And now they're slowly expanding their API, and they do have at least a partial web interface, so you can link to a photo and you can see comments and like the photo. But they still don't have a full web interface for the service.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. Part of the problem here, sorry, we're giving you kind of a weak answer, Travis. Part of the problem here is I don't use Google Plus, so I don't really, I don't really know. It's hard for me to kind of place this into context. So it's kind of speculation. It seems like Google Plus should have the same strategy as Twitter because they're going to end up putting ads on this stuff too. But there's that angle of Google where their attitude just seems to be, you know, to their credit, their attitude on a lot of things is more just like, let's get the data and let's move the data around. Let's provide data services to people. And then we'll figure out how to turn that into a ad revenue later. Right.
Right.
It's like, mm-hmm. They seem to be more in the business of moving bits on behalf of the user first and foremost, and then figure out how to analyze that data and make money off of it. or put ads on it, right?
I think that's true. They have the luxury in some ways that they're so big, they can kind of experiment and try different things without having to make money on those apps right away. And then eventually, you know, before you know it, you start seeing ads in those and then it's too late.
But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, from a developer perspective too, I'm trying to think like the Instagram example, if that's bad in any way, this sort of flipped approach that he mentions, because I can see, I have an app idea that's around photos and I could see pulling in photos from Instagram and aggregating some of that stuff, which would be allowed by the API today. And I'm trying to think like, you know, would we ever get into a situation a year from now where they would pull a Twitter and where I would regret developing for the service? And I can't really think of a scenario like that right now. It seems like if they have an API that allows you to pull photos from the timeline, that they'd keep that.
Yeah. Unless they want to put ads on everything. I mean, it is Facebook.
Yeah. So how do you know? I mean, when you're developing for these APIs, because I mean, there's so many apps now that require some kind of, you know, API access to some service. And like, how do you judge this stuff when you're building a new app? How do you judge it and say, okay, this is going to be around, I can base a business on this?
How do you taste the wind? I don't know. Whoa, that was, you just like put me into a Buddhist Cohen mode or something. You know what? The fact of the matter is you can't, everything's up in the air, and, any API you depend on where a service controls it, that's beyond your control, you run the risk of them not caring about supporting that as much as you wish they did.
Yeah.
You know, I currently don't have support for Squarespace's latest product because they have deemed it unimportant to their customers to have an API for Squarespace 6. You know, Tumblr has been down periodically over the years, this recent 2 month stint where I was out of luck. And if I had been the developer of a Tumblr only app, I would have been, you know, pretty much up the creek.
Yeah.
So, you know, it makes me feel good not to be a one API, one service kind of, it's the flip side of, you know, it's a big pain in the neck supporting multiple services, but then when one of them goes AWOL on you, you don't get completely screwed by it.
Yeah. Well, also it's, you know, Mars Edit, if you think about the APIs, you do use some custom APIs now because you have to, like for Tumblr.
Yeah.
And maybe for Squarespace. But the core part of the blogging APIs are open, right? They're kind of a standard, an old corrupty standard. but it is a standard and it's open and no one can control it if they adhere to it. Whereas with Twitter, Facebook, Google+, these private APIs, they can have terms that say, if you use this, for example, you cannot mix app.net posts in with the Twitter timeline when you use our API. They can make these kind of statements, where with an open API that's a little bit generic in terms of services it supports, yeah, you have a little more assurance that this is not something they can control quite as well. I mean, they can still say, if you hit our servers, you can only do certain things. But I don't know. It feels a little more open. It feels a little more future-proof.
Yeah. And I feel pretty lucky actually that far and away the biggest, most successful, most important blogging system to Mars Edit customers is WordPress.
Mm-hmm.
WordPress is two things. It's a very successful hosted, you know, blogging service, WordPress.com. But it's also the, you know, famously open source WordPress.org.
Right.
And this is an interesting kind of setup, I think, because WordPress.com maintains the right to do things willy-nilly, however they want to, turn APIs on and off, support features, not support features. You know, there's some features of the WordPress API that are not supported by WordPress.com. But by and large, they're the same service. It's just one of them you run yourself, and one of them WordPress runs for you. So imagine how different something like Twitter, something like Instagram, something like Google Plus, something even like Blogger, you know, Blogspot mm-hmm. would be if every user essentially had the ability in their, you know, had in their back pocket the option to take their data and go host it themselves.
Yeah.
So that's a great safety valve for me with WordPress is not only do I have a ton of customers who are hosting it themselves or have another service hosting it, but there's just always that option. And I think that mm-hmm. sort of keeps WordPress, probably keeps WordPress.com, the commercial enterprise, sort of honest. They have to continue offering something that meets and exceeds what people can go roll for themselves with the open source product.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it's, I think we're lucky that WordPress kind of came of age sort of in the original blogging era where you had movable type and these kind of self-hosted things that have sort of faded away now, but they still have the legacy of that sort of attitude from the old days of installing your own blogging software. Like if WordPress had been invented like last year, would they even have the open source
right.
install on your own server? Probably not. It would probably just be WordPress.com. So,
well, you know what's funny is a lot of people credit WordPress's historic victory over movable type with the fact that they were so open source so early.
Yeah.
Movable type, this is funny because this is the distinction between open source as being visible versus being legally licensed.
Right. Yeah.
Because everybody who used movable type, you know, yourself included, you could see the source code, but it was a commercial product, right?
Right.
I think you paid for your license or you had some kind of special, like, you know, one person indie license or something.
Right. Well, and if I remember correctly, the first couple versions of movable type were truly open source, but when then the problem they ran into is when they tried to make it a business, they really were aggressive about turning it into a commercial license. So like you said, the source is available, but if you actually want to be a legal install, you have to pay a certain amount of money, especially if you're a business and you have, you know, more than just one user or whatnot. And that, I think that alienated a lot of users. And yeah, surprise, at the same time, WordPress was out and gaining momentum. And so people just kind of switched just because of that attitude.
And I hate the GPL and I will rant against it at any opportunity, but
yeah,
this is one of those interesting situations where WordPress was GPL by necessity because it was based on a GPL project. You know, Matt Mullenweg, the founder of WordPress, is a famously strong proponent of the GPL now. But at the time when he started WordPress, I believe he was fairly naive about licenses and was just kind of like, oh, well, we have to make it public. Okay, it's public.
Right.
But then it ended up just being, they ate movable type's lunch because of that. Everybody could self-install and even people who didn't want to, again, liked that sort of freedom to do that. So mm-hmm. anyway, that's kind of where this whole like tent and app.net stuff is trying to pull back to is this idea of having the option of owning your data and, you know, choosing your destiny for how things are just having a safety valve and out, you know, an out if the company who's providing you a service decides to start being dicks, you know?
Yeah. It'd be great if a handful of years from now, we could look back on these last like 5 years of closed source centralized services as like, oh, remember that when you couldn't control your data and, you know,
yeah.
those terrible dark days of the early 21st century.
We can hope that in a couple of years, Twitter is suffering. Beleaguered Twitter announces new open data access plan. We can fantasize, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, in the meantime, we still are all owned by Twitter and we do as they say. So, that's right. Manton Reese is not owned by Twitter. He's a free.
Twitter? What's?
He's a free. Twitter? He's a free man. He's not a number.
All right. Well, good talking to you again this week. Thanks everyone for listening. And if anyone's interested in sponsoring the show, you can check out corint.org/sponsorship for all the details.
Yep. And as always, it's always gratifying for us if you leave us a review at the iTunes store for podcasts. It's great to hear what you think about the show. Let us know if there's things we can improve, and be sure to send us your listener questions to feedback@coreint.org. Thanks a lot for listening.